Hello, my name is Gloria Rhodes. I'm the Outreach Librarian at San Diego State University. I have with me today Mr. Willie O'Ree, the first black player to play in the National Hockey League. Mr. O'Ree is going to share with us his story. He's going to talk about his life experiences, his early life, his experiences in the national playing hockey in the National Hockey League, and anything else he'd like to share with us. Hello, Mr. O'Ree. Thank you for being here at San Diego State with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It certainly is a pleasure to be here.
Okay. What I'd like for you to start off with is to tell us about your early life, your experiences, and your education, elementary, junior high school, and how you migrated to the Hockey League, National Hockey League.
Well, first of all, I was born in Canada, the Maritime Provinces. I was born in Fredericton, New Brunswick, on the Atlantic coast. I was the youngest of 13 children. Had a great childhood. Started elementary school, and then I went to junior high, and then to high school. But going back, I was I started skating at the age of 2, and I started playing organized hockey at the age of 5. And you know, like all the boys and girls in Canada, you just played up through the ranks. And I, my older brother was my mentor, not only my friend and my brother, but he was my mentor. And he taught me a lot of things that I would need to know if I was going to pursue hockey as a career. Elementary school was fine. High school, I did 3 years of high school. And then I left my home when I was 17 to go up to Quebec, Canada to play my first year of junior hockey. It was a farm team of the Montreal Canadiens. My second year, I went to Kitchener, Ontario, and played for a team called the Kitchener-Waterloo Canucks. It was also a farm team of the Montreal Canadiens. And if you're unaware of that, back then, none of the hockey players wore any helmets, no face shields, no face guards. The goalies didn't wear any masks. There was no protection on your face. So you always had to protect yourself, you know, during the game. An unfortunate accident when I was playing my second year junior, there was a puck shot towards the net, and it was deflected. I'm in front of the net, and the puck came up and struck me in the right eye, and I lost 97% vision in my right eye. I remember dropping down to the ice, and I could feel the blood rushing down my face. And the next thing I knew, I was placed in an ambulance and taken to the hospital. Dr. Henderson was the surgeon, a fine surgeon, but the impact of the puck completely shattered the retina in my right eye, and he told me I was going to be blind and I'd never play hockey again.
How old were you?
I was 19. Okay. You know, the goals and dreams that I had of hopefully playing professional hockey and one day maybe playing in the National Hockey League seemingly were gone. So I got out of the hospital and I started back skating again. And the only difference I felt about myself is I just couldn't see it in my right eye. I could skate as fast as ever and I could shoot the puck as fast, but there was this blind spot. And I was over skating the puck and I was missing the net. And I said, Willie, forget about what you can't see and concentrate on what you can see. So my game started to pick up, and I started scoring some goals. We started winning some games. I finished the season. Now, either the next year, I either have to turn professional or play amateur. And I kept my fingers crossed that I'd be contacted by a professional coach. Pont Chemlac was the coach and general manager of the Quebec Aces, a professional team up in Quebec, Canada. And he contacted me and said, Willie, I watched you play the last couple of years, and I'd like to invite you to training camp with the Quebec Aces. So I went to their training camp, and I made the team. But I didn't tell them that I couldn't see it on my right eye, because back then you had to have a certain percent of vision in each eye, and I was blind in my right eye. But I said, if I could make the team with one eye, I said, don't tell them that you can't see. So we won the championship that year. It was like winning the Stanley Cup in the National Hockey League. That's what gave me the extra confidence that I needed. I said, Willie, you can do anything you set your mind to do if you feel strongly within your heart and within your mind. And what I tell these boys and girls when I go and speak is, if you think you can, you can. If you think you can't, you're right. And there's a lot of truth to that.
Mm-hmm. So after the Quebec Aces, what did you do?
After the Quebec Aces, I played one year with the Quebec Aces. And in 1958, the Boston Bruins contacted the Quebec Aces and said, we want to meet the Boston Bruins in Montreal to play two games, Saturday night in Montreal and then Sunday in Boston. So when I stepped on the ice on January the 18th, 1958, I became the first black player to play in the National Hockey League. It really didn't register with me. I was just so excited to play in a regular National Hockey League game and then finally beat the Montreal Canadiens in their own rink. We beat them 3-0. That night, we get on the train and we go to Boston, and the Canadiens beat us 5-3 in Boston. And then I went back to Quebec and finished the season up with the Quebec Aces. And I was keeping my fingers crossed that hopefully I'd get another chance to come up with the Bruins. And it came in 1960. I was recalled back up and played with the Bruins in 1960 and 61. And then I left the National Hockey League in 1961. I was traded to the Montreal Canadiens, who were operating in the National Hockey League. I went and started with their team in Hull, Ottawa, the Hull, Ottawa Canadiens. I started there, and then I was traded to the Los Angeles Blades of the Western Hockey League. So in November of 1961, I came out to Los Angeles and played 6 years with the Los Angeles Blades. Now, this is before the Los Angeles Kings came into Los Angeles. But when then the first expansion of the National Hockey League was in 1967. So they weren't going to have two professional teams in Los Angeles. So the team that I was on disbanded. And I was wondering where I was going to go. I was contacted by Max McNabb, who was the coach and general manager of the San Diego Gulls, and Bob Breitbart, who was the founder of the Sports Arena and the Breitbart Hall of Fame. They said, Willie, we have a chance of getting hold of your contract. How would you like to come to San Diego? Well, I was playing against San Diego my last year in Los Angeles. And at the Sports Arena, every weekend they'd sell the building out, 14,300 and some fans, screaming fans. So I said, yeah. I says, if we can work something out, I would love to come to San Diego. Well, I made three trips down. First of all, when I first came, we couldn't come to an agreement as far as my contract. And so I go back to Los Angeles, and then I came down the following weekend, and Max McNabb said, well, he says, we want you to come and play in San Diego. You've been a thorn in our side when you played up in Los Angeles, and Mr. Breitbart wants you. So I came down one other time, and then I signed a one-year contract with the San Diego Gulls, played that year, and then I played with the San Diego Gulls for 7 years.
And after your, what were some of your experiences playing in San Diego with the Gulls?
Okay. Oh, they were great. I had great teammates. My center iceman was Warren Hines. In 1965, in Los Angeles, Warren Hines was my center iceman, and I won the goal scoring in 1965, scoring 38 goals. And then when I came to San Diego in 1969, Warren Hines was my center iceman again, and I won the goal scoring again in 1969. Great team. It was a great organization. We had some great players, and it was a family team. We kind of just gelled together, and we played as one.
Did you encounter any racial discord or anything of that nature?
I did. A little in the Western Hockey League. Most of it was in the National Hockey League when I came up. When I was first brought up, being the only black player in the National Hockey League, and there were only six teams in the National Hockey League at that time. There were two from Canada, Montreal and Toronto, and then there was Chicago, New York, Boston, and Detroit. So going into Chicago and Detroit. And I had racial slurs and remarks from from fans and from players on the opposition, but I just decided, names will never hurt you. Mm-hmm. And I learned this from my older brother, who was my mentor. He said, Willie, he says, just go out and play hockey and concentrate and stay focused on what you want to do. And if they can't accept you for just the individual that you are, then it's their problem. And basically, that's what I did every game I went out. And there wasn't a game that went by that there were, racial slurs and racial remarks. And, when I was in the American Hockey League, I played in Tidewater, Virginia, and they threw cotton balls on the ice, and they threw a live black cat on the ice and said, you ought to be back in the cotton fields and things of this nature. But I just let it went in one ear and out the other, because I knew if it got to me, then I'd get off my game, and that I didn't want that.
That's a really good experience to, not that experience, but telling for students or young people to listen to how you overcame those obstacles that were placed in front of you. And once you left the San Diego, or during San Diego, what were some of the things that you did when you were not playing hockey in San Diego?
Well, when I was not playing, I sold season tickets and programs for the San Diego Gulls. I went out and spoke at numerous schools, elementary schools, middle schools, junior high schools. I did speaking engagement at Boys and Girls Clubs, YWCAs. Got out and did hockey clinics to try and introduce more boys and girls into the game of hockey and let them know that there is another sport that they can play if they want to. And it didn't seem like a job. It was just a lot of fun. My dad told me, he said, Willie, find a job you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And there's a lot of truth to that. Find something that you really love doing. And basically, the job that I have now, just going into my 18th season, it doesn't seem like a job. It's just a lot of fun.
So before we get into your job now, when you were talking to students in Boys and Girls Club, there were students of all diversity, yes. And how did you, because hockey is not something that we see black students interest, so how did you approach them? What was your story to get them interested in playing on the ice instead of other things that they would be
Well,
doing?
First of all, I told them, how I started. Mm-hmm. And basically, I was born and raised in cold weather. I had a rink in my backyard. I used to skate to school. There were ponds and lakes and rivers and creeks that you could skate on, so the availability of ice was there. Some of the boys and girls, didn't have that area where they could speak. Some of them had to travel quite a distance to get on the ice. But I just tell them that I use my accident as an example. And when the doctor told me that I would never play hockey again, I just couldn't accept that, because he didn't know the goals that I had set for myself and the dreams I had about hopefully playing professional hockey and hopefully one day getting into the National Hockey League. And I just said, I'm going to prove this doctor wrong. And so I tell these boys and girls, I played professional hockey for 21 years with one eye, so you can do anything you set your mind to do if you feel strongly within your heart and within your mind.
Tell us a little about your practice sessions. How did you prepare for hockey? What were some of the things that you encountered to prepare for games? And for the person who is not really familiar with hockey itself, kind of give us a schedule of what it was like for you during those times, your professional time on the hockey rink.
Well, in Los Angeles, there would be scheduled practices, and then there would be scheduled games. We'd play 70 games during the season, 35 home games and 35 away. And basically what I did is I always kept my weight down, and I tried to keep my body in the best physical condition there is. There was workouts where you could go and gyms that you could work out. But I just told myself, I said, Willie, I said, you want to be the best hockey player you could be, and you want to represent the hockey club to the best of your ability. And so I'd meditate before games. My daily game would, if we were playing that night, we would have a light skate in the morning, and then I'd go home and have a dinner, usually back then we used to have a steak and a baked potato, and then I would go for a walk, and then I'd have a little rest, and then I'd get up and prepare myself for the game, dress, and then go to the arena. And the first thing I'd do is I'd go in and check over my skates and my sticks, because your skates were always sharpened and your sticks were numbered and they were there, and I'd always make sure that they felt good, and I'd always check my gear out, and then basically I'd just sit down and then start to dress for the game. Now a lot of players would put half their gear on and then wait and then put the other half on. Some would just put on their underwear and then their shin guards and socks, and that's all. And then they'd wait. Everybody had their own little technique of what they would do, and a lot of them were had their own ways. I would sit down and I would dress and put my hockey pants on, and then I would just kind of concentrate and meditate for a few minutes. There'd be other people talking in the dressing room, and then I'd finish getting my getting dressed, and then the last thing I'd do is I'd put my skates on and do my skates up, and then I'd be ready to go out on the ice.
Now, how did you travel? You say you had 35 home games and 35 away games. I would imagine the travel changed from the time you first started till and what were some of the modes of transportation, and what were some of the encounters on the if you care to share,
sure.
On the road and everything?
I'll explain. When I was playing for the National Hockey League, there were only six teams, so we traveled by train because the cities were so close. Mm-hmm. When I was first called up, we played in Montreal on a Saturday night. Both teams got on the train, went to Boston, and played there Sunday. At Detroit, Montreal, Toronto, Detroit, we always traveled by train. When I came to the Western League, we flew. The only time we would take a bus is when we flew into the city. The bus would be there to take us from the airport to the hotel. The Western Hockey League, over the 7 years that I played with the Gulls, we always traveled by air.
You said now you. What are you doing now? How do you? It sounds almost like you're a motivational speaker.
Yes, yes, I am. And okay.
What is the message? What do you want the young people to know?
I want them to set goals for themselves and work towards their goals. You know, you can do anything you set your mind to do. You know, as I mentioned, you know, if you feel strongly within your heart and within your mind, and I tell these boys and girls, there's no disgrace in failing. The disgrace is not trying. And the old expression is that, like, first you don't succeed, then try again. And there's a lot of truth to that. Again, I use my eye injury as an example. What you can do if you feel strongly within your heart and you have that desire just to work hard. There's no substitute for hard work. If anybody tells you there is, they're lying to you. You only get out of a thing what you put into it. And if you go out and work as hard as you can, then you should pat yourself on the back. But if you go out and just go through the motions and expect to get 80 or 90% out, you're only fooling yourself, really.
What is your typical day like now in San Diego? What do you do? Well, just even not only now, what are some of your experiences in San Diego playing with the Gulls early on? And maybe distinguish that from your experiences in Los Angeles.
Well, in Los Angeles, I worked for the hockey club also in Los Angeles. And then I worked for you only played hockey for 6 months back then, so you had to. You played hockey for 6 months, so you had to have an off-season job for 6 months. I worked for a a service in Inglewood. It was called Econolite. They put together traffic signals and controllers, and I worked in the service department there for two.
Is it called? Econolite.
Econolite.
Okay.
I worked for the Pepsi-Cola company in Los Angeles. I drove a service truck and made deliveries. I worked for the hockey club in ticket sales and programs, like I did in San Diego.
You said 6 months. That was 6 months playing hockey.
Yes.
And did you have to train prior to those 6 months of the hockey league itself, the play
time? I did. I worked in the summertime. Yeah, I went and worked out at a gym. And I wanted to keep my my weight at my playing weight, mm-hmm. but you know, in the summer you go home and you just kind of take it easy.
Right.
But then when you come to training camp, because when you play your last regular season game, you weigh out. They put you on the scale and over 182 pounds. So I weighed out 182 pounds. When you come back the next year, you weigh in. And O'Ree's 205 pound. Well, there's something wrong. So
right.
There you have to work. You have to work hard in training camp. But what I did is I kept my weight down. So when I had come back to start the regular season, I would be maybe 1 or 2 pounds from my playing weight. And see, a lot of guys that didn't do that. They just go home and have a lot of fun. But you had to pay for that when you came back.
So discipline.
Discipline, yes. That's why I was able to play, even though I played with one eye, that's why I was able to play for 21 years. I disciplined myself and stayed focused on what I wanted to do and just went on a daily basis.
Did you do anything in San Diego as far as, I know you did speaking engagements and everything. Were you a part of any civil rights movements or
no? Okay. Nothing like that. I was mostly working for the hockey club.
What were today, and especially being the first black in the National Hockey League, were there opportunities for endorsements back in those days?
You would
think that people would be wanting you to endorse everything.
I know, but it didn't really. See, I never had an agent.
Okay.
You didn't make a lot of money, but the players now they all have agents and managers. Mm-hmm. But no, I always negotiated my own contract, and I really didn't have the opportunity to get. To get involved in any endorsements. I have an agent now. He lives up in Los Angeles, and from time to time he does get me some speaking engagements out of San Diego, which I'm paid for, and some card signings where I travel. But
So there were hockey cards, just like their baseball and
yes,
okay.
Yeah, there are hockey cards. I have 8 or 9 different hockey cards out at the present.
Mm-hmm.
Upper Deck out of Carlsbad. They have several of my cards.
And where do you have signing engagements? Is it during the hockey season?
It's summer during the hockey season, and I was back in Waterville, Maine, at Colby College.
Mm-hmm.
They contacted my agent and wanted me to come back, and I flew back there. Was back there for about 4 days, and I spoke at the Colby College.
What was your affiliation with Colby College?
Pardon me?
How were you affiliated with Colby College?
I wasn't. They just Colby College apparently got on the internet.
Okay.
And found out that I did motivational speaking,
mm-hmm.
and so they they got a hold of my agent, and my agent called me and said there'll be a lady contacting you and wanting to know if you'd like to go back to Colby College. And so that that came about back there. I was in Boston for a card signing. I just came back from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. I did a card signing in an autograph section back there.
You were inducted in the Sports Hall of Fame, San Diego Sports Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Can you kind of tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yes.
And what year was that?
It was in 1968.
You were nominated?
Yes, for the Breitbart Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. In Balboa Park. Mm-hmm. I was inducted into the New Brunswick Sports Hall of Fame in my hometown. I received the Order of Canada, which is the highest award given to a civilian 4 years ago.
What was the name of it?
The Order of Canada. There was a there's a rink in my hometown called the Willie Ree Place, dedicated to myself. Mm-hmm. It's a nice rink. It's a lot of kids get a lot of enjoyment going there and playing.
And it's in your hometown of
Fredericton.
Fredericton.
Yeah, it's spelled FREDERICTON, Fredericton, New Brunswick.
What was your, what is the biggest difference in the, in Canada, the atmosphere playing, mm-hmm. and in, well, you can do the East Coast, Boston, and also compare it to the West Coast, Los Angeles and San Diego? Was it the fans? Well, I know the weather had a lot to do with
it. Yeah.
But just the whole, how people were engaged in the sport of hockey, and
well, you know,
can you kind of compare
born
that?
And raised in Canada, they say Canada hockey is their sport. Mm-hmm. The western provinces, where it's cold, you'll have boys and girls playing hockey there almost year round. Myself, I was on the ice every day in the wintertime. Although I was going to school, but I kept my grades up. That was one of the big factors. My parents said you can play as many sports as you want, but you need to keep your grades up, and which I did. Coming to the United States, there is some racial problems in Canada, but not to the degree there are in the United States. Mm-hmm. And when I was, I was also considered a pretty fair baseball player.
Okay.
And I played baseball to keep my legs in shape, I could make a few bucks playing in my hometown. In 1956, I was playing for the Marysville Royals, which was a suburb of Fredericton. And I was scouted by two scouts from the Milwaukee Braves minor league operations in mm-hmm. Waycross, Georgia. And they said, "Mr. Wee, we'd like you to come to Waycross to try out for the Milwaukee Braves minor league operations." Well, when they said Waycross, Georgia, I said, "No, I said, I'm not interested," because I knew the way the blacks were treated in the South. They said, "Well, you're giving up just a fabulous opportunity. There's not too many, boys of your age that have the opportunity." I said, "Well, I certainly appreciate it, but I'm just going to stay in my hometown and play and prepare myself to go away to training camp." So they said, "Well, we'll be leaving in a couple of days. Here's my business card. If you decide, give us a call." But I didn't call them, but they called me again. And then, so I decided that I was going to go. So I left my hometown, and I flew into Atlanta. First time I'd been in the South. Flew into Atlanta, Georgia.
That was in 1956?
1956. I walked into the terminal, The first thing I saw was white only and colored only. So I walked into the colored restroom, and then when I come out, I contacted a black cab driver that was out in front of the terminal, and I explained my situation. I have to stay in Atlanta overnight. Could you recommend a hotel? So he takes me to an all-black neighborhood, a nice little hotel. I stayed there. The next day, I'm on the bus for Waycross. It's about an hour and a half bus ride. Get to Waycross, Georgia. I was assigned a dorm with seven or eight players of color. There were no white players. These were players of color. I was assigned a uniform. We started training. And then, you heard the racial slurs and the racial remarks directed, from the white players. But I just concentrated on, I was a shortstop and second baseman. And so I just concentrated on playing baseball. The first week went by, and I'm still there. And on your dorm, there was a sheet of paper, and if your name appeared on this list, that means you were going to be sent back home. Well, I was going into my second week, and my name hadn't appeared on the list. And then just towards the end of the second week, my name appears, and so I go into the office, and they said, "Mr. O'Ree, we were impressed with your play, but we think you need a little more seasoning. We've made arrangements for you to go back to your home and try out for the baseball team there." Well, blacks had to sit in the back of the bus, which was different for me, because in Canada, blacks could sit in anywhere in the bus. Mm-hmm. So I get on the bus, and I sit on the back of the bus. I'm 5 days on the bus, and I'm traveling up through the states, and as I'm getting closer up north, I start moving up on the bus, and I'm sitting in the center of the bus, and I get to Bangor, Maine, and I'm sitting at the front of the bus. Another 2.5 or 3 hours, I arrive in my hometown. I stepped off the bus, and I said, "Willie, forget about baseball. Concentrate on hockey." And I was contacted by Punch Emlak, and that's right. How I
you're saying started. Punch Emlak?
Punch, P-U-N-C-H.
Okay.
Emlak is I-M-L-A-C-H.
Okay.
He later on coached the Toronto Maple Leafs in the National Hockey League. But I was...
So baseball was not for you.
Baseball was not for me. I made the decision. And a lot of people say I was a better ball player than a hockey player, but my desire to play hockey was there. I just had that desire, and I said I'm going to play it, and I'm going to play and stay focused on what I wanted to do. But the drinking fountains, down south, and I was always keeping my eye out where I could go and where I couldn't go, and things of this nature, and it was all different.
Right.
It was just different.
And not something you really wanted to be.
No,
yeah.
No. Even if they had offered me a contract, I would have turned it down, because I just wanted to go back home and get ready for hockey.
Now, if you could go back in time, is there anything you regret doing or wish you had done better?
Anything I regret doing? Well, I really can't say that there's anything that I would regret. Growing up, my parents were very supportive of what I did, of the sports and my schooling. My mom was a housewife. She took care of the house. My dad worked for the city of Fredericton. Most of my brothers and sisters had moved away. My younger sister and myself were the only two living home as growing up. And then my sister left and got married and moved to Montreal. And then I was still living at home. When I went to Quebec to play my first year, I came back and stayed with my parents that summer. Then when I went to Kitchener, I came back and stayed with my parents after, and then I left in 1961. But I can.
Do you go back?
Huh?
How often do you go back?
I try and go back at least once a year, but I haven't been back the last 3 years, just due to the fact that I had too much work to do here, but I'm planning on going back next June to go fishing with some of my buddies, and I still have a niece and a nephew living in my hometown, and I have some dearest friends that I've known for over 60 years that have still lived there, and we stay in touch either by phone or text or by letter.
Right. It's really easy these days to stay in touch.
It is.
With all the technology. One thing what did your parents do? What sort of work
My mom just took care of the house. My dad worked for the city of Fredericton in the engineer department. And in the summertime, he would be in control of the street cleaning. Mm-hmm. In the wintertime, he'd be in control of the trucks that we came to remove the snow from the streets, the snow blowers. He worked for 38 years from the city of Fredericton. Then he retired, and my mom was the housewife, and I played, played baseball and helped with the financial end of it.
Then you had you talked about an older brother who was a inspiration to you. What, how much older and what did he do?
Well, he worked for a fruit company, the Willett Fruit Company. In other words, then he would drive a truck. What they would do was they would load his truck with fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. and then he'd drive to these small towns and stop at this little grocery store and take some oranges and apples and onions off, and then he'd go to the next one. And mm-hmm. he worked for the Willett Fruit for years, and I used to travel with him sometimes, we talk about hockey, and he taught me how to drive stick shift. That's how I learned to drive. He taught me to drive on a stick shift. As I mentioned, he was not only my brother and my friend, but he was my mentor. He just taught me a lot of things that I would need to know. He taught me about.
So would you say he had the biggest influence?
Oh yes. Being yourself and being proud of who you are. Mm-hmm. And he says, regardless of what they say, and I mentioned this, if they can't accept you for the individual that you are, then it's their tough luck. Mm-hmm. And he says, name calling, he says, you can't change the color of your skin, you wouldn't want to.
Right.
When you get up in the morning, I don't see when I look in the mirror, I don't see a brown man or a black man. I just see a man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about your the housing in Canada? Was it different? Like you were saying, your experience in Georgia. There was the black section and white section. Was it the same in Canada, or was it was more inclusive?
Well, it was more inclusive. I was born in my first home, and we lived at 245 Charlotte Street. It was a two-story house, and back then they had midwives, mm-hmm. And I was born there. Had a great childhood. Had some great friends.
What were some of the things you did for fun?
During the summertime, you'd play baseball. I played 9 different sports when I was growing up. They were available, and if you wanted to play them, they were there. If you didn't want to play them, they weren't there. I played volleyball, basketball. I played softball. Played rugby in high school for 2 years. We won the championship for 2 years. Played baseball. Soccer wasn't introduced back then, mm-hmm. but played volleyball. I used to fish a lot with my brother in the summertime. We'd go on fishing trips and just have a great time. Just growing up was just a lot of fun. I can't remember having any bad experiences as I was growing up. When I was 14, I met Jackie Robinson for the first time in Ebbetsfield, in Brooklyn. Yeah, we won the championship.
How old were you?
14. Okay. We won the championship. the baseball team, and our reward was that we were going to be taken to New York to see the Empire State Building and Radio Music City Hall, Coney Island, and I met Jackie Robinson after a game, and shook hands with him. Told him that I not only played baseball, Mr. Robinson, but I played hockey, and he says, "Oh, I didn't know there were any black kids playing hockey." It was a great thrill, and he made a big impact on me. In 1962, when I was playing in Los Angeles, Mr. Robinson was the keynote speaker at the NAACP luncheon. Mm-hmm. I got an invitation through the hockey club, and Coach Agar and myself and two other players went to the luncheon. As we arrived, Mr. Robinson was standing over in the corner talking to a couple of media people, mm-hmm. and we were just off to the side. When he finished, Coach Agar went over and said, "Mr. Robinson," he said, "I'd like to introduce you to a couple of hockey players, especially this is Willie O'Ree, newly acquired from the Hull Ottawa Canadiens." And when I turned to Mr. Robinson, shook hands with him, he said to me, "Willie O'Ree," says, "you're the young fellow I met in Brooklyn." Now, from 1949 to 1962.
And he remembered you.
He remembered.
Wow.
I mean, I was in awe.
Do you have pictures of your
meeting?
No,
I wish I did have.
Yeah.
I wish I did have.
Yes.
But, yeah.
That's amazing that he would.
Remember, yeah. He says, "you're the young fellow I met in Brooklyn." Mm. I must have made an impact on him back then as he made an impact on myself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's why they, you know, being the first black player in the National Hockey League, they call me the Jack of Robinson of hockey.
I've heard
you know,
that.
I never said I was the Jack of Robinson. It was the media.
Right.
You know, that it was the media said every time they say, "oh, Willie O'Ree, yeah, he's the Jackie Robinson of hockey."
Well, that's a good, Jackie Robinson is a good person to be
yes.
aligned with.
Exactly. Yes, to be in the same category as Mr. Robinson.
So is there anything else you would like to say? Is there any, I know you have throughout the conversation shared bits of wisdom and little golden nuggets that our mm-hmm. youth can take with us and adults as well. Is there anything that you would like to end on to just a message to get out to people watching this or listening to your?
I would just like to you know say that we are three individuals within ourselves. We're a person who we think we are, we're a person who other people think we are, and we're a person who we really are. And to find the person who you really are, you know, work towards your goals, stay focused on what you want to do, and just work hard and be all that you can be. Be proud of who you are. You know, feel good about yourself, like yourself. If you feel good about yourself and if you like yourself, other people are going to like you. They can't help but like you.
Right.
But if you have this negative attitude going around, don't expect people to, you know, want to associate with you. And I have to thank Commissioner Bettman of the National Hockey League for appointing me the director of the back then the NHL's diversity program.
Mm-hmm.
Now our new logo is Hockey is for Everyone, and the message that I extend to these boys and girls is that the same thing, you know, work hard, set goals for yourselves, and be all that you can be. And basically, I think that's what life's all about.
Can you expound on the diversity program in
yes.
the National Hockey League? Tell us a little
yes.
about that. I think people would be very interested in that.
The Hockey is for Everyone program is a program. We have about 60 programs throughout North America, and they're operated through the NHL, but they're funded through their own organizations, but the NHL will donate $100,000 a year for these boys and girls for these programs, and they can send in and you know ask for funds for traveling for uniforms. It's a great program. My duties are to travel around to these programs and do on and off ice clinics, speaking engagements, personal appearance, autograph sessions, and it's we're just letting these boys and girls know that there is another sport that they can play if they want to. It costs $50 a year for these boys to play, or girls to play. And if they can't afford it, we won't turn any boy or girl away. As long as they want to stay in school and keep their grades up, we'll make it affordable for these boys and girls to play. And it's just a great program.
So the diversity program itself, it's a training program for boys and girls who are interested.
We will teach boys and girls how to skate.
And this nationwide or worldwide?
I would say it's worldwide, because Norm Flynn, one of the directors, he has eight programs. He has two in Ireland, and then he has them throughout Canada. He has one in Montreal. He has one in Vancouver, in Toronto. He has one, and they're doing very well.
So when the students, when the boys and girls apply for the program, and what time frame are they in that program, for a specific time frame, and is it on an individual basis, on a team basis?
It's individual basis, but we have boys and girls that have been in the program for 8-9 years and come back as role models and to help these other
so they mentor sort of mentoring
and mentoring programs. And we've had one particular young fella, Gerald Coleman. There was a program in Chicago called PUCK, Positive Uplifting of Chicago Kids. It was called PUCK. Gerald was a 13-year-old, little skinny 13-year-old. He wanted to be a goalie. I met him when he was 13 in Chicago. I was there for the Willie O'Ree hockey program. Gerald said, Mr. Ree says, I want to be a goalie. I want to play in the National Hockey League. His friend said, Gerald, he says, you won't make it because of your color. You won't make it because there's not that many black goaltenders. He says, stick to basketball. He says, you're a good basketball player. He says, no. His parents either just tried to turn him away from hockey, but he says, no. He stayed focused on what he wanted to do. He was drafted by the Tampa Bay Lightning of the National Hockey League and played with the Tampa Bay Lightning. So there's just one example of this 13-year-old little skinny kid says, I'm going to play in the National Hockey League. And that's basically what he did. He stayed focused on what he wanted to do. And
so the program, you train them physically, and you train work with them mentally, emotionally, and then you provide them with
equipment. Yeah, we have volunteers. If it wasn't for the volunteers with our programs, the programs wouldn't exist. We have volunteers that will come and pick these boys and girls up from their home, bring them to the rink to practice or play, then make sure that they get back to their home safely.
And is this year-round, or is it a specific time of the year?
Just through the hockey season.
And the hockey season is from what to what?
Well, they start training in September, and they just finished here just a little over 2 weeks ago. So from September to June.
Okay.
But a lot of the programs end in March and April, because it's the National Hockey League. They go on because they have they've had 30 teams and there's only 16 teams that make the playoffs. But it's a great program. I wouldn't have stayed with it for 17 years if I didn't think the program worked. I really wouldn't. And I tell these boys and girls, I would never lie to you. If I tell you something, it's coming from my heart. And
so what do you do now?
Right now I'm home for a while. I was watching the Stanley Cup finals, and then
home is San Diego now.
Home is San Diego. I came to San Diego in 1967 and married my wife in 1969. I just love San Diego. I fell in love with the climate.
Okay.
And that's the truth.
Very good. So again, thank you very much, Mr. O'Ree, for being a part of the oral history program here at San Diego State. We really appreciate you sharing your story, and we look forward to our researchers and students, faculty, staff, listening to your life story.
Well, thank you. If there's down the road, if you feel that you want to contact me, if there's something, please don't hesitate to give me a call.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Or text.
Will do.